sun, it doesn't. We think, used to think everything goes in our particular galaxy, it doesn't. We used to think everything was part of our galactic group, it wasn't. We used to think we're the center of this particular universe, we're not. And we used to think that this is the only universe there is. Lots of evidence is slowly gathering. Another thing that's a real mind-blower, of all the stuff you see out there, with all the astronomical radio telescope, infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray, all of those measurements that have been made all of these years constitute a couple percent of this particular universe. A hell of a lot of the stuff, the majority of the stuff that's out there, is dark. You don't see it. It's dark energy and dark matter. You know it's dark matter because you can easily calculate how much gravity is required to keep a galaxy together. A galaxy is 10 to the 12 stars. That's 100 billion stars, all going around a massive number of black holes in the center. That's what the average galaxy is. They're slowly discovering you got a massive number of black holes in the center, keeping it all together. But if you look at the distribution of the velocities of all of the stuff in a galaxy, and we've now got thousands of galaxies to look at, 10 to the 10 galaxies you've got to look at. You look at the velocity profiles of them, you realize that there is distributed gravity throughout the galaxy that's 80 or 90% more than what you see. Only a couple of percent is the observable stuff. There's a hell of a lot of other stuff unobserved. So a lot more to be discovered. You need Hubble, you need bigger Hubbles, you need more space telescopes in order to figure out how it all goes together, where is our place in it, where is it all going, and so on. Fascinating. And I can see a lot of advantage in doing this kind of research. I mean, a very conservative person can say, gee, we should be spending our money feeding people who are starving to death and solving mankind's problems. You've got to do a little bit of other blue sky research to figure out where you sit in the whole thing, to be humbled a little bit. If multiple societies on this planet that are warring with each other would dedicate themselves to a crazy goal, just understanding astronomy, astrophysics, as opposed to fighting each other. As crazy as it sounds, it's a better goal. You get benefit out of it. In the process of developing the hardware that allows you to make those measurements, you are solving mankind's problems as a side effect. Every dollar you put into NASA, you get $10 or $20 back on fallout. In other words, you think you're developing a nose cone for a missile that you're sending out there in space. Well, that happens to be ceramic hardware that ceramic dishes are part of the result of that. Some of the computer programs and computing devices that we use for doing navigation of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, the result of that is the thing that's in your pocket now, that kind of a calculator you've got in your pocket used to fill up a room as big as your living room. And now you've got that kind of technology in your pocket. And so whenever you do pure research in any area, even though you think the immediate goal is crazy, expensive, and useless, guarantee somebody is going to find a way of using the steps you use to get there. That's a belief. And it's backed up by a whole lot of favorable history. So I'm convinced that although it's off to one side, it doesn't look like you're directly solving mankind's problems. In the big picture, you're probably solving mankind's problems more rapidly. You're solving mankind's problems by doing this kind of work. Okay, let's see, we've asked Eddie, we've asked Walt, we talked to Mark. Tom, give us a brief transmission. Let's see how we're hearing you right now. I know you've got two antenna questions. That's one of my favorite subjects. W2, Hotel Victor Kilowatt, I believe it is. K2RIW TechNet. My name is Tom. Hope you make it, Tom. Not a good sign. I'm not hearing Tom right now. Maybe the propagation has changed. I wonder if we've got Paul. WS2N, are you on board, Paul? Hello, anybody? Hey, Mel, are you and I alone? Anyone else want to check in? Any further comments, questions, or whatever? Give me your caller's name right now. KQLIW.
K2QB in Spring Valley.
KC2, OLA in Massapequa.
B2BXO in Brooklyn.
Hey, K2RIW. This is KB2LQN again. Listen, another comment I just wanted to throw out to you. They were showing a video of a 1959 Air Force reconnaissance bomber that was actually recording on the radar images they were getting on these orbs that were flying right by them, first one at a time and then in formation going from 5,000 miles per hour to 9,000 miles per hour. Amazing. So there's a lot to be learned out there. And it's very, very mind-boggling, so to speak. What I think we're going to do is get out of amateur radio, and maybe the messages are coming down in cosmic rays, and we're missing them, you know? Think about what I'm saying.
Well, you've got a good point there, Walt. We were doing radio astronomy measurements for zillions of years, and all of a sudden somebody, by mistake, so to speak, put a loudspeaker on it and realized that there was pulses coming in, and that's how Jocelyn Bell and a few other people in roughly 1968 discovered pulsars, pulsating stars. And so if you take a look at the X-rays, the ultraviolet, the infrared, the optical, and whatever, and look for pulses in it, there's a good chance that some number of those emitters have pulses. And maybe the pulses are natural in the case of pulsars, or maybe they're unnatural in the case of extraterrestrial intelligence. Search for SETI, SETI. There's all kinds of ways of doing a SETI search. We used to think the longest range you get out of radio. Well, we used to send radio signals, well, we still are sending radio signals down our cable TV systems. We used to think it's the lowest insertion to get the signal from point A to point B. All of a sudden, fiber optics came along. And instead of getting 100 dB of loss per mile in coax cable, you get 1 dB of loss per mile in a fiber optic cable. So optics has got and you get zillions of megacycles of bandwidth out of fiber. We're all going to have fiber to the curb in some near period of time because we just can't get enough bandwidth with our internet and bidirectional telephone and data and everything else that we want. We all want more bandwidth. It looks like optical is the way to do it. Maybe eventually it's going to be X-ray. Let's see, we got QN, OLA, BDXO, and so on. K2QN first. To start off with your name, sir, I think it was QN. Start off with your name and your question or comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Could it be
QBA? Yes, it is QBV. I can't read my writing. Start off with your name, sir.
K2QBV is Joel. I'm rather excited to watch TV with my ex-wife. But I have a question. The people who do our lawns broke my ground. I had a terrible one outside. I'm going to put a good ground outside. I can't get into the ground. What do you suggest? Hammer it away, drill it away, pour in salt. Any suggestions?
Okay, when it comes to ground, you've got at least three reasons that people put up a ground. One of them is for human safety, to make sure that the chassis of your rig doesn't get 110 volts hot on it, and you touch the chassis and touch a radiator or a water pipe and light up. That's your highest priority for putting up a ground. Your second highest priority for putting up a ground usually is lightning protection. We all think because we've got a massive chunk of metal up in the air, in our mind, my radio tower, my 100-foot-high radio tower on top of 300 feet of land in Huntington, I think it's the biggest chunk of metal around, and lightning just wants to hit it all the time. Well, I was here for 30 years and never got struck with lightning until I made some changes to that system, and all of a sudden I was struck with lightning one day. But as I studied the details of my lightning strike, it did not occur to my tower. It occurred to the 110-volt line. Your 110-volt line, if you had X-ray vision, you look at it down, it's a great big set of monkey bars, you know, a big network, a grid, a web across the town. It's a huge target, and 99.9% of the time, lightning is going to strike your loco and your LIPA and your Con Ed power way ahead of touching your antenna. Your dipole and your tower up there, you think it's a big target. You'll be amazed how small the target is. But go ahead and put on lightning protection. because it is belt and suspenders, it's the right thing to do. And the third reason people put up the ground is they believe that a good grounding will give them less television interference. Now that one's the more difficult one to support. Rarely does creating a better ground stop television interference. Television interference comes from a whole lot of other things and not grounding. Common sense would lead you to believe good grounding would stop TDI. Not much. You're going to get a couple of dB of change, but it's not a showstopper, if you know what I mean. So once you realize why you're putting up the ground, if it's for protection for shock potential, a good heavy piece of wire to a copper water pipe is an extremely good ground. If it's for lightning protection, the wire to the water pipe may be kind of long, it might be kind of inductive, and it may not give you enough lightning protection. So a rod in the background, the EIA standard for lightning protection is a 5/8 diameter rod made out of galvanized steel or copper coating, 8 feet long, pounded into the ground, with the top of it below grade, and a piece of 6-gauge wire going between it and the tower, or whatever else you want grounded. A shorter piece of wire as possible, with as few bends in it as possible. Each bend represents an inductive as far as the lightning strike is concerned, and the lightning may decide it ain't going to go around the bend, and it's going to ignore your ground. So, even if you've got sandy soil, an EIA standard ground does buy a lot for you. So, pounding a rod in the ground is one of... Pounding a rod in the ground is one of the very good ways of getting a ground, Joel. So I wonder if any of this helps. K2QBV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It does, but it came out of the ground. I can't get down that far. I have a transformer that I never put in. It's called an ultra-isolator noise suppressor. And it's a real, besides a noise suppressor, it's really an isolation transformer. Remember, it's something like a million to one isolation. I have got to run. We'll continue this with you. But, in fact, I'm just looking at the sheet for the suppression out here. It's like big time, but we'll continue the time, and I'm going to go. We'll see you later. Thank you for your help. But I didn't think it'd be TDI or just protection. K2QBV in Spring Valley, New York. See you soon. Thank you for your help.
Very fine, Joel. Joseph is next. K2OLA. Go ahead, Joe. I was pretty sure K2OLA signed. Is Mr. OLA there? Okay, Mr. BXO. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, very good. Name, as you know, is Frank. My question, Dick, was you mentioned, which you partially answered, was you mentioned that optical setting may turn out, for a number of reasons, to be more productive than radio setting, which has been the traditional approach, we assume, since we communicate over distances via radio, that other societies will do the same. We're realizing that assumption may not be correct. But I wasn't clear on how you were suggesting to do, either how optical setting is being done or how you're suggesting to do it. You've answered partly by saying looking for light emitters may be intelligent, you know, made by intelligence rather than natural. And I was wondering whether you meant something more specific, like shooting coherent light, laser light into deep space aimed at specific potential star systems, or, for that matter, looking for laser light aimed with us. And since laser light is coherent and very narrowly focused, whether that would really have all that much potential working, since a laser has to be aimed in the right place to be seen, as I understand it. Or, for that matter, what other approaches you had in mind. I think I have seen the Blue Book show, the History Channel, showing earlier. I think that's an old one. And I don't remember the details of it, but my impression was more sizzle than steak. A lot of speculation, as all of these things still are at this point. K2RIW in the group, WB2BXO.
Very fine, Frank. The main thing that's required when you do a SETI search or any kind of inter-space communication, you've got to send enough signal in the right direction so that it's above threshold of the receiver the guy is using on the other end, so they can detect the signal and get the modulation out of it, and you're talking to them, so to speak. When you calculate free space loss versus frequency, at first you say, why go to higher frequencies? The loss goes up as you go to higher frequencies at 20 dB per octave. Every time you double the frequency, you've got, I take it back, 20 dB per decade. Anyhow, 6 dB per octave. Every time you double the frequency, you've got 6 dB more insertion loss of free space. Well, free space has no loss. You run a 1-watt transmitter in your room, and you put a certain number of watts into the wall, so to speak, and if the wall is absorptive, you can calculate how many watts per square meter and how much heat you're going to get on that absorptive wall. The space in between runs ice cold. Space has no loss. So what's really going on with an antenna is everything you and I call an antenna that has anything that we call gain really means it's like a flashlight. It's focusing the signal in some direction by taking it away from some other direction. The antenna doesn't have a power supply. It doesn't have real gain like an amplifier. It only has gain by comparison to something that radiates like a light bulb in all directions, and it's got to squirt the signal in one direction. So as you go higher and higher frequency, the same size of antenna that you're using gives you more gain. It does more focusing. It's a more narrow beam width. That's where the gain is coming from. And when it comes to interstellar distances, you've got a tremendous amount of loss to overcome. Between stars, you've got numbers like 400 decibels of loss. So unless you're running a zillion-watt transmitter into a high-gain antenna, the guy in the other end ain't going to hear you. So already, whenever you're doing a SETI search, whether you're doing it with low-frequency radio, high-frequency radio, optical, or whatever, you got to aim it in the right direction. But once you decide you got to aim it in the right direction, you might as well go for the highest gain you can get and hope you have enough precision of aiming. As you gather enough information with good radio telescopes, let me drop a second. Even though there's no beep, I think there's a timer on this machine. Got to ask Andy about that one. As you gather enough optical information, astronomy information, you know which stars are good candidates. We're slowly discovering which stars have planets going around them. Pretty soon we're going to know which stars have got Earth-like planets going around them. Therefore, these are the high probability candidates. We're going to aim our laser beam, our optical thing, at those particular stars. That's the only way you're going to overcome the distance. You've got to aim a narrow beam. And so, yes, you've got an aiming problem. But if you've got enough hardware on the ground, you can hop in between all of those stars during a listening event. You can listen to 1,000 stars in a night by listening to each one of them for some number of seconds, or you can hop between them in some kind of a protocol. But still, yes, you have to decide which direction it is. But if you're keeping the antenna size constant in diameter, that's the easiest way to normalize the whole problem. You've got a fixed diameter of real estate in which you can establish an antenna. If it's Arecibo, it's a 1,000-foot diameter dish, and it's the biggest antenna we've ever built of a parabolic kind. When it comes to parabolic optical dishes, some of these multimeter diameter things you've got down in Chile and in Hawaii are the biggest optical ones we've got. So you're limited in the amount of real estate you can use for the sending / receiving device. Once you've accepted that limitation, and the limitation is because of the geometry you've got, because of the amount of real estate you've got, or the number of dollars you've got some kind of a limitation of size. Once you accept that size limitation, then you want the highest possible gain. Highest possible gain pushes you into the highest possible frequency. Highest possible frequency with that size of antenna means you get a more and more narrow beam width. The more and more narrow beam width means you've got to be more precise with the aiming. Once you're more precise with the aiming, now you've got to be intelligent with where you aim. You don't want to aim at the dead stars, the red dwarfs, the white, the neutron stars, the black holes, the ones that don't possibly have life. You now aim at the more desirable sounding or looking candidates. So that's part of the problem. What frequency do you tune to? What exact wavelength? What kind of modulation do you look for? What instantaneous beam width you use? Of bandwidth, what instantaneous bandwidth you use? What method of detection? Angular detection, envelope detection, coherent detection. How much computer processing do you use for the signal to dig the signal out of the noise? I mean, there's another whole field that's just now really breaking through because of what Joe Taylor is doing, K2JT, your Nobel laureate ham radio operator. He has invented these great computer techniques where it used to take 400 square feet of antenna on the 432 megacycle band with 1,500 watts of power going into it with less than 1 dB of noise figure in order to hear your echo off the moon. With Joe Taylor's computer codes, which can now dig the signal out of the noise and use fancy... And they use fancy modulation techniques, you can now take a single Yagi on the chimney of your house, aimed at the horizon, without even an elevation control, put a 100 watt solid state transmitter into it on 2 meters, and talk to somebody on Moonbounce, who is similarly equipped. He's given you a 20 decibel advantage. He can take signals that are 28 dB below the noise and suck the signal out of that. And now, because his system is working so well, you got a whole bunch of guys out there screaming and hollering that, hey, this ain't fair. But I've spent 15 years doing Moonbounce the hard way, where the old definition used to be one set of human ears during one sitting, listens to that signal, here's a full set of call letters, here's the unknown piece of information like a signal report or a location, and that is a valid QSO. When you pass that information back and forth with Rogers and confirmation, that's a QSO. All of a sudden, you got these computer programs that give you a 20 decibel advantage. Some Johnny-come-lately comes along with a single Yagi, works a whole lot of Moonbounce, and all of a sudden, he puts your hard-earned record over the last 15 years. He challenges you with a minuscule amount of hardware. And so, do you put him in a different category? Is it a valid QSO when the signal is being picked out of the noise by a computer? Well, the signal is being picked out of the noise by a computer when you do radio teletype. Is radio teletype a valid QSO? We hold contests on radio teletype. So you got this great big gray zone. But that's the ham radio version of it. But with the right kind of a computer program that can search for the signal and the noise and look for all the various kinds of modulation, with the right kind of an antenna that's big enough, that's sensitive enough, that you aim it in the right direction at the right candidate stars, that's the newest techniques that are going to be used for search for extraterrestrial intelligence. As usual, the problem has gotten more complicated. But you're finding out more, you're getting more smart, and you know where to aim it, and this is the way you're going to get greater and greater range, weaker and weaker signals, more and more sensitivity, more and more instantaneous equivalent bandwidth, better and better searches for whatever looks unusual and unnatural in that signal that's buried in the noise. And so you now got these mixer devices, multi-channel, very wideband computer processing systems where you can take thousands and thousands of megacycles of instantaneous bandwidth out of a radio telescope IF system, put it into a real fast digital analog to digital converter. You got a zillion bits of digital data flying by. You put it into the right kind of a multi-channel computer network, which synthesizes for you zillions and zillions of channels that are 1 hertz wide each. And therefore, you're looking for the best possible sensitivity of an extremely narrow, let's say, a continuous carrier signal in the noise. Continuous carrier signal in the noise at 1 hertz of bandwidth. With that multi-channel computer networking system. So lots and lots of ways with the new hardware of doing deeper and deeper searches over a greater and greater bandwidth at higher and higher frequencies with better and better equipment aimed in the right direction. These are some of the trends as I see it for search for extraterrestrial intelligence, Frank. KB2BXO, K2LIW in the TechNet. Good question.
And you just knocked a couple of years off my age by calling me a KB2, but that's all right. At this point in my life, I think that's a good thing. That's WB2BXO. In any case, that's essentially what I thought the answer was. And that also sheds light sort of on another point is, you know, the famous August 1978 WOW signal, which I know Mel is quite familiar with, that certainly looks to a fair number of people like it could have been a coherent signal created, you know, by some intelligence rather than something natural. And as I understand it, one of the problems with analyzing that piece of data is, first of all, there's only one data point, which raises a whole bunch of questions on its own. Second of all, that since the only thing it was recorded on was a strip of paper, you can't apply all these modern computing techniques to it, apparently. And we'd be able to do a heck of a lot more with that one data point now than we were able to do when it was last heard in 1978. Go ahead, Dick.
Very fine, Joel. I mean, Frank, sorry about the W2BXO, WB2BXO, K2RIW. Yeah, I've attended a number of lectures on that WOW signal. I also visited that site. That was in Delaware, Ohio. It was John Krause, W8JK's massive radio telescope. I think it was 100 feet wide. Was it 150 feet wide? Anyhow, massive radio telescope running at the 1420 megacycles, had a zillion dB of gain, filled up this great big football field, so to speak, and the radio telescope didn't have one feed horn, it had two feed horns side by side, and it's a so-called meridian transit telescope. You can had an extremely narrow fan beam in, let's call it azimuth, but a broad beam in elevation, and you could aim the elevation at various spots. So they are set at a particular elevation, and they wait for the Earth rotation once every 24 hours, roughly 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds in celestial time. The Earth makes one revolution, 360 degrees. So you can calculate how many degrees per minute. I think it turns out to be 15 degrees per minute the Earth rotates. So you have this very narrow fan beam sweeping across space, 15 degrees per hour, I should have said, 1 degree every 4 minutes, and it sweeps across a strong signal, and that so-called WOW signal, I don't know the exact number, but it looked to me like it was 30 decibels above the noise, called S9 plus 10 dB, if you like, potent signal. Because that radio telescope has two feed horns side by side, I think it's something like 2 minutes later, the second feed horn is looking at the exact same point in space, and it saw the exact same signal strength WOW signal. So two separate events separated by something like 4 minutes. In other words, first the signal swept through the first feed horn, then it swept through the second feed horn, same frequency, same angles, and whatever. Once you've got that kind of a system, you can get rid of a hell of a lot of the phony signals that were some kind of a burst out of a satellite or whatever. This thing fit all the right requirement as being a real signal coming out there from a far distance in space. It wasn't a satellite. It wasn't local interference or whatever. It fit the right. It fit the right signature. Unfortunately, they go back to that angle in space, that exact frequency, those exact times of the day or whatever, multiple times over, never saw the signal again. And yes, it was a computer printout. It's a computer printout telling you amplitude by first going through the number system, then going through the letter system, and so on. It was an alphanumeric amplitude indicator on a broadband detector. Now, you and I wish there was a loudspeaker and a tape recorder connected to that IF strip with either an AM, an FM, or a sideband detector connected to that IF strip. We sure wish we could have heard that signal, that the machine was just reporting what was the amplitude it saw across that bandwidth. And maybe it was 100 meg instantaneous bandwidth. I'm not sure what the instantaneous bandwidth of the receiver was. Probably more narrow than that. Anyhow, no human set of ears listened to it. No real coherent demodulation was taking place. Just simple amplitude recording, which was the way that radio astronomy was done in those days. It was somebody like Jocelyn Bell, and if you watched the program called Contact, and you saw Jodie Foster as being one of the radio astronomers who represented Jocelyn Bell, by the way, who would listen with earphones and say, I want to hear the noise. want to hear if there's something in there. And so we're getting more smart as time goes on. Just simply figuring out the power coming from some direction is not enough of the whole story. So maybe that's some of what you're asking about. Yes, it didn't repeat, and what was it is a darn interesting question. WB2BXO for any further comments or questions. K2LAW on the TechNet.
Yeah, that's basically it. You know, I heard, I'm sure, the same lecture, I guess, from Paul Shook, and asked him the same question. And, yeah, that is rather frustrating. Just nobody thought of it. You know, I guess nobody expected this. What does it sound like? And try to demodulate it. There's just not enough data there to go back and, I guess, reconstruct it and say, okay, what did this thing sound like? Because as you said, you just have one dimension, amplitude. We don't have frequency, we don't have sidebands. I think that was Paul's explanation, was that, you know, with no measurement of the sidebands, there's no way to get any, look for any intelligent information out of it. And, you know, I asked him about, well, what, you know, what are the explanations of being heard just once, you know, we've all heard of very brief reflected paths, media bursts and stuff, and VHF propagation, you know, terrestrial propagation and stuff. I said, how about some kind of reflected path? And his explanation, which I'm sure you've heard also, was that it probably came through gravitational lensing, you know, on a once in a million chance. That gravitational lens will occur, you know, in that place and that time, so we would hear that signal. Anyway, very interesting area. I'll let you move on to other people. WB2BXO.
Very fine, Frank. Frank, your microphone on that particular rig sounds like it's got a scratchy wire. Sometimes your audio is loud, sometimes your audio is scratchy. We heard every word you said. But your audio goes up and down in volume and changes in characteristics, and we hear some other squiggly noises in there. So your particular microphone, you ought to listen on a second rig while you're transmitting with the first rig and wiggle around that wiring, and I think you're going to see that there's a intermittent there somewhere that you'd like to know about. Yeah, Paul Shook, as part of one of his lectures, Astronomical Amateur Radio Astronomy Society. Gosh, all of a sudden I can't think of the name of the organization that has a meeting once every year at Green Bank, West Virginia. And I've attended quite a few of those. Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. And so he's given quite a few lectures there about the WOW signal. Unfortunately, that Delaware Radio Telescope, Delaware, Ohio, has been taken apart, because the land became too valuable, and then it turned into either a golf course or a housing development. There was a golf course nearby. I had a chance to walk around that hardware and go below ground and see the actual equipment made by Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I was working for AIL at the time. I was on vacation in Ohio, and I just dropped into that facility, and they gave me the grand tour, because I came from the company that gave them their low noise front end. I wasn't connected with that project, but I didn't bother telling them that. Although I knew very well the people who were. And when it comes to sensitive receivers, for a period of time, parametric amplifiers are the cat's meow. At much higher frequencies, they still are. Nowadays, cryo-feds, cryogenically cooled gas feds, give you a hell of a lot more performance with a lot less hardware and a lot easier a way of setting it all up, a lot less dollars required. Any self-respecting moon-bounce operator these days is using a gas-fed front-end, which has a small fraction of one decibel of noise figure. Their electronic noise is down to numbers like 50 degrees Kelvin, minus 240 degrees centigrade, is the electronic magnitude of the noise of the front-end. The lower that number, the more sensitive it is. If you could make a one-degree noise figure front-end, you'd love to have it, and most of us would spend a lot of money to get such a thing like that. Just a matter of time before we will have it. And so when you've got an antenna aimed at cold sky, the noise coming into the antenna itself is so small that the majority of the noise of that system is your own receiver electronics, your own low noise front end. No matter how many dollars you put into it, no matter how much technology you put into it, once you've got a real good antenna aimed at a cold point in the sky, you'd like to have a receiver that is colder than that, so that the noise is not coming from your electronics, but it's coming from the sky. You want to measure the noise of the sky and the signal-to-noise ratio of the real signal, not the signal-to-noise ratio that's being buried by the noise of your own receiver. And so the average guy thinks, gee, if I've got a 1 dB noise figure front end, which means 77 degrees Kelvin, roughly, and if somebody gives me a 0 dB noise figure front end, I go from 1 dB noise figure front end to 0 dB noise figure front end, I'd only pick up 1 decibel of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. It is true if and only if you're making a measurement in a room temperature system. If you're measuring the sensitivity with lab equipment, where you've got a room temperature signal generator going into your receiver, yes, 1 dB change in the noise figure will be 1 dB change in the sensitivity of your receiver. But connect that receiver to a real good antenna aimed at a cold point in space where the space is 3 degrees Kelvin, and you go from 77 degrees Kelvin system to 3 degrees Kelvin system, you're going to pick up something like 20 decibels improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. Of course, that sounds crazy. How can a 1 dB change in noise figure give me more than 10 dB of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio? It actually would be a 13 dB in that exact calculation. 13. How can 1 dB change in noise figure make the signal-to-noise ratio move by 13 dB? And the answer is cryogenics. When you're in the cryogenic system, in other words, whenever you're below room temperature of your antenna plus electronics, the only thing that behaves in a linear manner is degrees Kelvin of an electronic temperature. Decibels of noise figure no longer behave in a linear manner. So you got to be careful. You got to use a different set of math to find out what's happening. Now you know why some people will try very, very hard to get super low noise front ends. When you are running a satellite receiver system, that's the 18-inch diameter dish that gives you direct TV, it's running a receiver aimed at cold sky, listening to 12 gigahertz signals coming from a satellite, and the low noise amplifier that's in the center of that feed horn, the low noise block down converter, feed horn plus amplifier plus converter assembly, that's all in the front of that dish, it's running at something like 50 degrees Kelvin. And so, if that dish is looking at one branch of one tree with leaves on that tree, and the tree is at room temperature, 290 Kelvin, but your electronics is 50 degrees Kelvin, as far as that dish is concerned, that tree is a white, hot blowtorch of radio noise. That's what the leaf is, making radio noise. You would think that your direct TV system aimed through a branch of a tree is getting loss of signal because of the insertion loss of the branch. That's not the dominant factor. It's the noise emitted by the branch that's the dominant factor. The insertion loss of the branch is a secondary factor. That's the reason why your direct TV system must look directly into cold blue sky without any branches or buildings or anything else in between if you want good reception. It's a cryogenic system, opposite of common sense. And the next thing that's opposite of common sense with that direct TV system is that when a great big rain cloud comes along and your signal freezes on the screen, you go below a signal-to-noise ratio. You would think it's the insertion loss of the rain that's doing it. Good common sense. That ain't it. The system is polarization diversity. In other words, all the odd channels are running clockwise, all the even channels are running clockwise, circular polarization in that downlink from that satellite. And all those frequencies are 100% overlapped. The upper half of channel 1, all of channel 2, and the lower half of channel 3 are all overlapped with each other. I'm talking about the transponder channels from the satellite itself. I'm not talking about the channel number you tune to. I'm talking about the transponder channels from the satellite. They're 100% overlapped. So when you're listening to the counterclockwise signal on transponder number two, if a raindrop comes along and the raindrops get big enough, so the raindrops are not round anymore, they start taking on a tear-shaped shape. The signal going through those tear-shaped raindrops starts mixing clockwise and counterclockwise signals together, because the raindrop ain't round anymore. The raindrop is absorbing and re-emitting the signal that hits it at X-band, and the raindrops are significant in size compared to X-band. It starts mixing the clockwise and the counterclockwise. The poor receiver says, I'm hearing a jumble, a garbage. I can't figure out what that is. I'm going to freeze the picture until those raindrops get out of the way. That's the reason why your satellite system freezes during a rainstorm, a heavy rainstorm. The raindrops somewhere in that atmosphere have to be big enough in diameter. They ain't round enough anymore where you get that effect. It's not the insertion loss of the rain. It's the cross-polarization characteristics of the rain. That's a very well-kept secret. You'd be amazed how many microwave mavens don't know that. Even antenna designers don't know that. The schools don't tell you that kind of information. Hey, with any further comments on all of the above, give me a call, let us a name right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
K2KY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? You got it, Mel.
Hey, having graduated and attending the Ohio State University for a while, I got to know that system fairly intimately. The director of that system over there in Ohio was a friend of mine, Dr. Bob Dixon, WADRD, and he sent me, we had many QSOs, oh boy, I more or less questioned him a few times, I think, to the point of exhaustion, and I got the WOW, famous WOW printout here, right in front of me. I keep this as I don't know, just something to gaze at every so often, saying, what in the heck could have been? Must have gone through this 100 times already. It took place on August 15th, 1977, 22 hours and 15 minutes and 36 seconds, Eastern Standard Time, and the signal lasted, the copy of the signal lasted about 61 seconds, and the antenna system that they had. I got all the particulars of the whole piece of equipment that they had there. I was under that thing a number of times, and the system was designed to operate between 1400 and 1750 megs. And yes, I'm looking at the two-stage gas vet tram that you built over here, Dick, that you said the company, I think, you were involved with building the gas vet, over.
Yes, it was Airborne Instruments Laboratory that built the low noise front end, which in the beginning was parametric amplifiers when I visited them in, roughly 1975, 73, somewhere around there is when I visited them. They were using AIL parametric amplifiers. Later on downrange, they were using gas vet amplifiers because they're simpler, more reliable, and even slightly better in performance. By the way, that WOW signal, in order to receive that signal, a bunch of things have to come together. And so the next thing we should have discussed, I should have mentioned, is called POI, probability of intercept. In order for you to receive that signal, you have to be tuned to the right frequency, with the right bandwidth, with the right method of detection. Your antenna has to be aimed at the right direction, at the right period of time. I mean, it's possible that the guys that sent out that signal, let me speculate, it was some other star, they looked at desirable stars, like our sun, and said, hey, that's a good direction to send a signal. We'll send a signal there for 15 minutes once every month. And if during that particular 15-minute period during the month you happen to be having your receiver aimed in that direction, tuned to that frequency, and listening to that signal, you get intercept. But the rest of the month you can have your most sensitive receiver aimed at that guy that's doing the emitting, and he's busy transmitting in some other direction. And you don't have probability of intercept. So a lot of things have to come together. The only way you can get around that problem is a whole lot of parallel hardware. You got a whole lot of receivers running in parallel, all listening to various frequencies in real time, without time sharing. You got a whole bunch of radio telescopes simultaneously aimed at a whole bunch of highly desirable stars. So you got diversity of angle of arrival. You got diversity of frequency of reception. You probably need diversity of polarization, whether it be horizontal, vertical, clockwise, counterclockwise, or whatever. And so you need a whole bunch of diversities in order to increase your probability of detection. It takes a lot of hardware to really increase your chances. But as you add more and more hardware to the project and properly set it up with the right kind of protocol, your chances of success continuously increases. Was there ever a pink elephant? You'll never know until you conduct a search for a pink elephant. You can sit here and speculate till the cows come home. Until you find one, you never know if there was one. So you gotta have a whole lot of researchers out there looking at a whole lot of forests, at a whole lot of areas where there are elephants, to find out if there ever was an albino elephant, was there ever a pink one? I'm sure there was, but until you find one, you can't prove it. That's sort of where we are with SETI search. K2UIW, you got it, Mel.
Roger. Now, you know Bob Dixon also, Dr. Dixon, he also laid out a whole design for VLBI. What the heck is it? Remember what I'm trying to remember. Oh, very long baseline interferometry. I remember quite a bit of discussion on that subject where he hoped to link together a number of systems so that it would be, you know, to overcome the problem of one system to increase, I guess, the antenna directivity in other words, to reduce the size, these large physical installations, he proposed the very long baseline interferometry, which basically would link a number of different antenna systems together to one location where a supercomputer would most likely be able to determine, you know, I'm trying to remember the exact, you know, particulars of it, but I remember him with the discussion of this type of process and all, but I don't know whatever really took place with it after that thing over.
A lot took place. He had an excellent idea. If this is the best possible of all worlds, and if you've got 150 acres to work with, you'd like to fill up the 150 acres with one great big antenna, whether it be a huge dish like you've got at Arecibo, or a whole bunch of dipoles, or a whole bunch of Yagis, all with just the right spacing, and a whole bunch of feed lines going into one great big corporate feeding network, and by some means you aim it. That's the best possible antenna. If you've got a lot of volume, a lot of acreage, and a lot of money. Okay? What do you do if you don't have enough money? You start making a partially filled array. Instead of putting in all of those dipoles or all of those Yagis, you put in every other one or every third one. Well, let's take it down to the limit. If you go down to the limit, you put in two Yagis, one on the far left-hand side of the field and one on the right-hand side of the field. You now have an interferometer. You don't get the gain of filling up the whole field, but you get the directivity of filling up the whole field. The whole field maybe gave you an antenna with 1 millidegree of beamwidth. Let me drop. So fill up the whole field, you get 1 millidegree of beamwidth, and you get a zillion dB of gain. Use only two antennas on the far left-hand side and the far right-hand side of the field. It's the same 1 millidegree of beamwidth. That's the good news. The bad news is you get a whole bunch of side lobes, and you don't get the gain. You don't have the effective capture area of filling up the whole field, but you get the directivity, the beamwidth. So when it comes to breaking down two stars that are side by side and you want to find out, is there one star there that's a wide one, or is it two individual stars side by side? You want to have enough directivity, you want to have enough beamwidth resolution, the interferometer can do it for you. One on the left-hand side of the field, one on the right-hand side of the field. And by the way, once you've got those two antennas there, you don't just simply combine the signal between the two, you put a phase shifter on one of them. As you put the phase shifter on one of them, you're steering that beam in space of that interferometer. The bad news of not filling it up, you've got a whole bunch of side lobes, so it's a whole bunch of fingers in space. But as you change the phase shift to one antenna versus the other, you are waving those fingers in space. And you can wave them back and forth so that one of the fingers, the middle one, the strongest one, is right on the star number one or star number two. And you can see the empty space between the two if you've got enough resolution. How far can you take that? Okay. Rather than try to buy a zillion acres of land, you put one antenna in Australia and one antenna in California. So you got them on almost opposite sides of the Earth. And you aim both of those antennas at the same star. And you've got something like 7,000 miles of separation between the two antennas. That's a 7,000-mile-long baseline interferometer. And that gives you fantastic resolution. You can now look at the micro-milli-degrees of resolution, if you know what I mean, so to speak. Small and small angular differences, you can now start separating things as long as the separation is along the dimension of your baseline between California and Australia, in my particular example. On top of that, as the Earth rotates 15 degrees per hour, one degree every 4 minutes, your interferometer is waving itself through space, even if you're not using phase shifting between the two. And yeah, you don't have one great big long piece of coax between Australia and California, Goldstone, California, and the Mojave Desert. What you do is you have an accurate clock. Let me drop. You have a real accurate clock and a broadband video recorder recording everything you hear from antenna number one in Australia. You have another accurate clock and a broadband recorder synchronized listening to the signal in California. You ship the tape that the guy in Australia made his measurements to the guy in California. He puts the two tapes together, runs them simultaneously, slowly phase shifts between the two, and now he is in non-real time duplicating the event of the original measurement. He can take his own sweet time, play those tape back a zillion times, in phase, out of phase, plus quadrature, minus quadrature, and so on. He is steering that beam in space electronically on the tape of the measurements that were made last week. And he can play it through the machine 50 times if he wants to, using different processing techniques. So very long baseline interferometry on opposite ends of the Earth is the maximum resolution at that frequency you're going to get on this planet. You can carry it to the next step if you want to. You can now launch a satellite into space, and it can be in orbit around the Sun at the exact same altitude above the Sun as the Earth is. And if you're smart enough, you set it up so you've got a satellite on the back side of the Sun, you've got the Earth on the near side of the Sun, and both of them have an antenna aimed at the same point in space. Now you're using the whole Dawn diameter of the Earth's orbit as a very, very long baseline interferometer. And boy, can you get resolution out of that. And there's been a lot of proposals to do that. They haven't done that one yet, but that's the next step. But the very long baseline interferometer, where you've got antennas in Canberra, Australia, Madrid, Spain, Mojave, California, and also maybe the other radio telescopes you've got in Virginia and Arecibo, Puerto Rico, start putting these radio telescopes together in multiple element, very long baseline interferometer. You can now synthesize an antenna pattern that's as sharp as all hell. It's got some side lobes to it. By shifting the phase of the recordings you make at those various sites, when you put it all together, you can figure out what's a side lobe, what's real, where's the star really, what is the angular separation between those two stars, or the trinary of stars, and so on. You can see where this can go. So, length of the baseline, the edges of the antenna, the dimension of the antenna, is what determines angular resolution. If you want a nice, simple formula for that, whether it be a feed horn, interferometer, or whatever, take 70 degrees, divide by the number of wavelengths of the dimension, If, for instance, it's my favorite feed horn, which happens to be 10 wavelengths wide, the mouth of a horn is 10 wavelengths wide. If it's an X-band horn, it's 10 inches wide. Divide 10 into 70, I get 7 degrees. My 10 wavelength wide X... My 10 wavelength wide X-band horn, 10 into 70 gives you 7. My 10 wavelength wide X-band horn is a 7 degree beam width antenna. If I made it 100 wavelengths wide, it would be 7/10 of a degree of beam width. If I made it 1,000 wavelengths wide, it'd be 0.07 degrees beam width. You see where I'm going here. You make your baseline long enough, you make the dimension of the horn wide enough, so to speak, you give me whatever angular resolution you want at that particular frequency. It's just the number of wavelengths of separation between your individual elements that tells you the angular resolution, or the beam width, if you like, of that particular antenna, if you're smart enough to put the data together the right way. That's what Robert Dixon was telling you about. You look at any of the publications of the Ohio University Electroscience Laboratory, or particularly the Delaware, Ohio Radio Telescope. And when I was down at Green Bank, West Virginia, I bought some of their publications where they published these beautiful maps that Dixon and Krauss measured on that radio telescope. Beautiful 14-20 megacycle maps of what the whole universe looked like. Almost every star that's emitting at the 14-20 megacycles is plotted on those maps. It was done by the computer processing programs, many of which were written by Rob Dixon. You were in front of one of the giants of the radio telescope world. You had a great opportunity there while you were at Ohio University, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW of the TechNet.
One question, Dick, KB2LQN here. What's that array of antennas out in the west called HARP all about?
Okay, you've got two big arrays out west. One is in Socorro, New Mexico, the very long baseline at the perimeter. I think, no, what is it called now? Very large array diameter, and there's 31 of them. That's one array. There's another big array. The HARP system was a 430 megacycle system, which does artificial heating of the ionosphere. One of the things that was discovered about 20 or 30 years ago is that you take a big enough array of high-power transmitters, you aim it straight up, you heat up the ionosphere, and you create artificial ionization. You and I, we talk about you and I talk about a band opening, which means the ionosphere is doing something desirable to you and me today. In other words, my favorite frequency might be 15 meters, and if 15 meters today is above the minimum usable frequency because of the state of the ionosphere, I get a beautiful reflection of the ionosphere.